and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com, broadcasting from the studios of WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with last night's primary election results from Pennsylvania, Maryland, Connecticut, Delaware, and Rhode Island, which resulted in a blowout victory in all states for Donald Trump on the Republican side and wins for Hillary Clinton in four of the five Democratic primaries, with Bernie Sanders winning in Rhode Island. We'll begin with an analysis of the way forward for Bernie Sanders following a statement last night from his campaign that did not mention winning the nomination, but rather focused on giving voters a chance to express themselves in the forthcoming primaries, and the Sanders campaign exercising its influence in the Democratic convention on behalf of the 8 million voters who have already demonstrated their support for the insurgent campaign of Senator Sanders. John Nichols, The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent, whose latest book with Robert McChesney is People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, joins us to discuss last night's election results and whether a Clinton-Trump presidential race will be the cakewalk for Hillary, as the Republicans fear and the Democrats gleefully anticipate. Then the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, Paul Soglin, joins us. He was active in that city's anti-war protests in the 1960s, which were chronicled in David Moranis' book, They Marched Into Sunlight. And we will discuss similarities with the anti-war movement of youthful activists back then to the current youthful insurgency inspired by Bernie Sanders, and assess a way forward for the Sanders movement beyond the current political races, given the energy and activism that has been generated, which, if channeled, could become the future of the Democratic Party or a powerful political movement on the left that could counter the rightward drift in America. And joining us now is John Nichols, who is The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and the author with Robert McChesney of a number of books, including Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And their latest book together is People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
Ian, it is great to be with you face to face.
It is wonderful to be in your hometown of Madison, Wisconsin. And let's talk about last night. I'm sure you're up late and you've been talking about it for some time today at the risk of repeating. I consider you well rehearsed. So what's your take? Let's start with the big blowout on the Republican side.
Well, first off, it's a pleasure to be speaking to you for one of my favorite radio stations in the studio of my hometown favorite radio station. So, I mean, we've got it all together here in the best of ways. And I think that your listeners are pretty savvy about what's going on. We don't have to, you know, kind of get lost in the silly punditry of the moment. We can go right to the chase. And that is that last night was more than just a victory for Donald Trump. It was almost certainly the pivot point at which he moves from being a, you know, strong contender, but somebody who the establishment of the Republican Party wants to block, to being somebody that the establishment of the Republican Party is probably going to have to get comfortable with, because it's awfully likely he is going to be the nominee. These wins were not just, you know, victories. These wins showed some things that the whole punditocracy of this country had denied up to this point. They kept saying, well, you know, he can't get above 35%, except maybe in his home state of New York. No. In state after state after state, including one major battleground state, Pennsylvania, which is often in play, he was getting, you know, over 50%, in many cases over 60%, sometimes heading towards 70%. And he was winning by such margins that in Pennsylvania, where they have a just absurd delegate process, you know, one where people are chosen at their local congressional district level without instruction, so they could kind of go where they want, which in many ways up till Tuesday seemed like the perfect setup for the establishment folks, whatever that is, that might want to beat him.
Ted Cruz, right?
Right, well, yeah, you know, whatever wants to beat him, right? But Trump did so well in so many congressional districts that last night, when they talked to these uninstructed delegates, they were all saying, well, I'm not going to go against my district on this level, you know, when you're getting 65, 70% of the vote. So this was an incredibly good night for Donald Trump. And he now pivots into Indiana, where he has a tremendous potential, because it's a state where his trade message, his message about the incredible damage done by free trade deals, is going to be very appealing. And then he moves on to other states where he's got real potential. So the end of the day is this. We have had a horrible theater over the last month of this so-called Never Trump or Stop Trump movement. It's starting to look, and Ian, you're a young man, but just old enough to remember in 1964 when there was a Stop Goldwater movement, and every element of the Republican establishment came out for every week they had a new candidate, you know, Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. and Nelson Rockefeller and George Romney and maybe even Richard Nixon. They even in the Illinois primary tried Margaret Chase Smith and finally William Scranton, and they lost it all. It never worked, and they ended up with a candidate who was unelectable, Barry Goldwater. So that gets us to your next question, though, which is Trump unelectable? And that's a big deal. Democrats love to imagine that he's completely unelectable, and they love pointing to these polls that show overwhelming numbers of people just don't like the guy. And the numbers are getting mind-blowing. I mean, in the African-American community, in the Latino community, among women, among young people, you get into the 70s and 80s, you know, just these overwhelming numbers. And you say to yourself, well, how could somebody possibly be viable politically with those kinds of numbers? Here's my counsel to you. Before you pop the champagne corks, understand that Donald Trump's genius, and frankly, I think we have to start to acknowledge there's a certain element of political genius here. He's beaten the entire, you know, all the smart guys in the Republican Party, all the consultants, all the Karl Roves, all these people, he's beaten them all. His genius is not to raise his own appeal, but to diminish other people at such a visceral and aggressive level. What he's done to Marco Rubio, little Marco, to Ted Cruz, Lion Ted, to, you know, all these figures that they thought were going to just, you know, roll over him. That's instructive. He is now going to turn this fire on Hillary Clinton. She's a more capable politician than most of these other figures. But do not underestimate that Trump is going to... Trump has a strategy, and if he's the nominee and if Hillary Clinton's the nominee, that strategy is to take her down so low that her voters, a lot of her voters, are disinclined to come vote for her. That they won't vote for him, but they're just going to be diminished and frustrated and angered by the process. And his voters, you know, that core of his voters will be inclined. That's politics. It's bad politics. It's low turnout politics. But it is the thing that Democrats are going to have to be very conscious of as the next few months go on.
And of course, last night in his victory speech, he sort of impishly suggested that Bernie Sanders should run as a third party. I mean,
he knows what he's doing there, doesn't
exactly
he?
But the thing that struck me, though, about last night's victory speech is that how different Trump is in the way that he handles the press. He's absolutely got them corralled.
Oh, yeah.
Controlled. He's gotten up to $1 billion worth of free media because he knows how to manipulate them and what they want to cover, and he feeds them these headlines endlessly. And most politicians, including Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders actually has a lot of contempt for the press, and rightly so, but they all live in fear of the press and mm-hmm. making mistake. He doesn't care. It's so obvious, and I think this is what makes him so scary, and this is not the year for status quo politicians. This is the year of insurgency, and if Bernie's not to be the insurgent on the left and this guy is to be the insurgent on the right, I don't know what's going to counter him.
Well, there are things that will counter him. I do think there's ways to do it, but let's get to that in a sec. But let's stick on your core point, which is an incredibly vital one. The story of the 2016 campaign is a media story, not a political story. Although there's huge political issues in play and there are huge economic issues in play, which are basically the subject of Bob in my book. But this media story is a big deal. We have been saying for 20 years, old media is collapsing, new media is developing. Well, what we see in 2016 is that we were wrong. Old media still kind of exists, and new media isn't really replacing it, except in the values of new media. This immediacy that you have to, you know, constantly feed the beast. You got to go for clicks. You got to have something every minute, right? That has become the standard across new and old media. And so now we have the so-called legitimate media, even to the New York Times, but certainly the cable shows, the broadcast news shows, much of radio. It's all like, oh, it's instantaneous. It's whatever happened this minute is a big deal. That makes a understaffed, underfinanced major media system, and it is that. They have far fewer reporters and far less reach than they used to because the advertising dollars aren't there. It makes an understaffed, underfunded major media into a dumb beast. And this dumb beast just desperately wants to be fed. Most of our political class doesn't begin to understand that. Not even on the bare level that it's at that, you know, really dumbed down to that point. Donald Trump not only understands it, he celebrates it. And so he feeds the dumb beast every day, and he has made the dumb beast loyal to him, addicted to, you know, the horrible gruel that he feeds it. And you say, well, he doesn't mind if he makes a mistake. I actually think it's to the point now where Trump occasionally throws a mistake in on purpose because if he's not getting that hyper level of coverage, he wants to turn that volume up so that nobody else fills the space. It's a media strategy, and it's one that Democrats, progressives, people who care about the future of the country, I think, you know, even conservative Republicans ought to understand is real. And the counter to that is not to try to beat Trump, because you're dealing with the master there. The counter to that is A, to make an explanation of that central to what you're talking about. We have to make media issues a part of our actual political discourse. If you're going to run against Donald Trump, you got to talk about why he gets the coverage he does, the overwhelming coverage. Make an issue of that. And then secondly, you have got to position an alternative that takes in, I would argue, the strengths of both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And this is an interesting dynamic. The genius of Hillary Clinton's campaign, whether you like her or not, is that she spent an immense amount of time this year nurturing a coalition politics, which the Democratic Party in the 1980s and 1990s actually tried to avoid, right? Tried to, you know, get away from with the Democratic Leadership Council and all these groups. She is running a Jesse Jackson Rainbow Coalition kind of coalitional message. She literally talks about what the economy does to Latino women, to African American women, that, you know, talks about a lot of what those who really know sophisticated, you know, economic and social analysis refer to as intersectionality. People who face, you know, multiple oppressions and multiple assaults on their economic circumstance, their social circumstance, their cultural circumstance. So she's really getting into stuff there that whether you like her or not, that's real. That is, and that has helped her very much to build coalitions out and to win in places where, you know, it was thought to have been competitive, and she actually won very, very big. Places like Maryland, places like New York. Same time, Bernie Sanders is offering not an old school economic populist message. Many people mistake it for that. It's actually a very kind of the moment, forward looking reflection on a dystopian economy. One that has far, far fewer opportunities and that has a future that looks even worse. And both of these messages are absolutely central to countering Donald Trump. You do have to have a liberation solidarity message. You have to build in a coalition that understands all of the neglected and disenfranchised communities that are potential voting blocks but have to be drawn into a process that has often pushed them away. You have to recognize that voter suppression, all these things are very real, and you got to be big on that. So give Hillary Clinton credit for recognizing that and making that a part of what she's done. But you also, to talk to all of these groups and to talk to young people especially, who are actually in many ways one of the most vulnerable voting blocks. They can be brought to the polls, but there are a lot of barriers, and there's also a lot of efforts to not only disenfranchise but disengage them. You have to be talking about that future in staggeringly realistic ways, and that involves a comfortable embrace of a social welfare state, a recognition that the economic future that is before us is not one that's going to be easy. So it's got to bring in, you know, these elements of a single-payer Medicare for All healthcare program, free education. Some things that Hillary Clinton has attacked, right, and said, oh, that's too airy-fairy, that's too big a dream. No, these are central components of what you need. So the answer is, as we come out of this Democratic race, and it's not done by any measure, it's going to go on through California, through even the District of Columbia's last primary or last vote of the bunch. The key to this is to recognize that neither of these candidates have the whole answer. And whoever the nominee is, and it does look more and more like Clinton, has got to incorporate huge components of the others, what has worked for the other. To think that the Democratic Party is a whole and is all united and is all linked together, that's just not the case. But it could be. And that's, for beating Trump, that's essential.
And again, I'm joined in the studio by John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, a daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and co-author with Robert McChesney of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And their latest book together just out is People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. So when you say that Donald Trump has created a way to feed the beast, he's not only has he created this new media narrative, all of which is earned media free, he's also able to control the press in ways that are just breathtaking compared to the rest of the political class that in many ways are cowed by the press. He has so successfully co-opted them. But not only has he created a new narrative to feed the beast, he's created a new language. And this is what concerns me, is that I think the others, and if it's Hillary, I still watch her campaigns and her speeches and the speech she gave last night. And while it's good and well written, it is in an old language that I think is about to become extinct by this harsh, new, take no prisoners kind of street language that Trump has injected into this campaign. And I think that is more in tune with the public because they are simply fed up with politicians. They're sick of them. And the more that Hillary sounds like a politician, the greater her chances of losing. And the more this guy, Donald Trump, doesn't sound like a politician, the greater his chances are of winning.
Well, he requires a low turnout. That's the essential thing. I mean, I do not think Donald Trump wins a high turnout election. But if we go to this concept of throwing so many negatives in, attacking so hard that you really do get people just horrified by the whole damn thing, then your point, I think, becomes really one to consider in a big way. Now, here's the interesting thing about Trump. He never finishes a sentence. He actually recognizes he's tweeting, right? I mean, his major statements are tweets, right? And if you've got to replace the word four with a actual number four, if you've got to cut something off and assume people are going to fill in the rest beyond your 170 characters, that's fine. Because there's an awful lot of us who communicate that way, even if we're not on Twitter, we've moved into this very rapid paced thing where there's all sorts of assumptions about what will fill in the space. Now that benefits him politically because he doesn't say some of the most horrible things that he implies, right? And so our dumb beast media, you know, says, oh, he seems to be playing around with this. No, he's not playing around with it. He's delivering that message. It's just that he doesn't have to fill in the blanks because his crowd actually, quote unquote, gets a lot of what he's saying. But there's something else about this that's important. And I think this is way missed by most analysis of Trump. Most people look at the guy and they say, boy, his rallies, you know, this is just sort of like rambling, you know. I mean, how can anybody spend, you know, an hour, 2 hours listening to that? Because it just kind of goes on and it's so self-referencing and so, you know, it's sort of like self-absorbed at a level that is almost beyond comprehension, even in politics. And here's the thing that I think everybody's missing. America has very little faith left in politics. Very little faith left in our economic elites. Our elites in general, we're pretty peeved at them. We don't like anything that they do. And so what America's basically looking for is an explainer in chief, right? Somebody who, you know, can just get up there and keep talking to us, right? And keep kind of walking us through these things. And who we're so into their storyline. We're living with them in their storyline so closely that, you know, if that person deviates off to 15 minutes talking about their wife and kids, we're with them. We're following them along. It is a little bit of reality television. It's a little bit of, you know, a populist slash authoritarian politics, the leader, the big leader who's got all the answers. It's a whole bunch of things in play. But the counter to Trump is not a smart soundbite. And that's gonna blow the minds of all the political consultants and elites who've spent, you know, 30 years lying their way through so many things with smart sound bites. That's not the counter. Trump doesn't do sound bites. Trump does often incoherent little bits and tweet kind of communications, but he does them in a two-hour hole. And then when he's done, he'll go turn someplace else and go keep on doing it some more. When he is awake, he's talking.
Well, and by the way, he'll invite the press at the end of it.
And now he's liking the press, if you'll notice, right? And this is the thing to understand about that is that's power. Power is the ability to be the explainer in chief. And if we go back and we say, in a very different man and frankly, much more heroic figure in an awful lot of ways, Franklin Roosevelt, when he didn't have all the answers to the Great Depression, and when he didn't have all the answers for how we're going to deal with fascism, how we're going to deal with a world war that might destroy the world, what did he do? Kept talking to us. He developed a storyline and a narrative, and he went on, and we sat around our radios, and, I mean, he would, you know what Roosevelt would do? I mean, we'd think, oh, the president's got to be in Washington. Roosevelt would take off on a train and go across the country and deliver dozens of speeches over the course of many months before he got back to Washington. And everybody covered it. Everybody paid attention to it. It was a long narrative. He made himself the dominant figure of that time. So he happened to be a pretty good guy. I think he led us through a lot of stuff. But the power of that is something to understand. And I don't think that our current political class and our current media class understands that we have moved to a point where we are, again, we're looking for an explainer in chief. The counter to Trump is an explainer in chief. It's somebody who can do it better and more effectively and bring in the media critique, bring in some of these other critiques of him. Now, in the current political context, I think actually Bernie Sanders is closer to that. If you go to his rallies, if you look at how he's approached it, he's gotten remarkably little media coverage compared to the other candidates. But I think he's actually pretty good at it. The thing is, whether you like or believe that or not, the likelihood now of him being the nominee is being reduced with each week. And so the political class, the political elites who don't want Donald Trump to be president had better figure this out. And to my mind, they better listen to Sanders a bit. They better listen to a lot of people who have some good ideas because they don't have very good ideas.
Right. So given that Trump has created a new media narrative, and as I suggested, he's gone beyond that. He's created a new language that's an anti-politician language, and that Hillary's definitely in a politician mode, even though she may have good writers for her. And what concerns me is when you talk about, and we need a new FDR, the version of the dark side, which is Donald Trump, which is essentially bread and circuses. And there's no serious component there in terms of policy. And I don't believe at the end of the day, you know, he's not going to make us all millionaires. It's not going to happen.
He doesn't even want to raise the minimum wage.
I don't think he has a clue about. But she has all the sort of wonkiness that you could possibly want. But my fear is that there is this kind of knee-jerk liberal approach to people like Donald Trump, which is a sort of self-righteous dismissal. And to me, that would be the worst possible way that you can handle this guy. You really do need an adult explainer in chief, but they have to be low-key, reasonable, quiet, not shrill like Hillary is.
Well, she can be low-key and quiet. I've interviewed Hillary Clinton and heard her, I think, at her very best. But here's the bottom line. You have to also be something else. You have to be authentic. You have to be something. People, whether you like that person or not, you got to believe them, right? And I think the more that you open up, the more that you let people into both your successes but also your pain, where you're not like a controlled and managed message, but you are actually something that's pretty open and goes pretty deep on issues, talks about it in really serious ways, instead of dumbing it down, actually building it out, the more possibility you've got. I heard Hillary Clinton give a speech the other day in Madison on the courts. It was exceptional. It was really deep and smart and good, and it made you... I was there with people who were Sanders backers and Clinton backers, and they were like, wow, that was actually strikingly good. About what the courts can do, about how, you know, they become a vehicle for justice. And all I'm saying is that you know, you can't make yourself into something you aren't, right? So you can't try to learn Trump's language and learn Trump's style. You have to recognize, though, what's working for him, and then you have to develop that which works as a counter to that. What I would suggest to you is this. I don't want to go too far down the track of saying, you know, what Hillary Clinton, if she's a Democratic nominee, has to be. What I would suggest to you is that we have another 2 months of or more of the Democratic Party's process. And instead of running away from that and trying to close that down and shut that down, I think people would be very well advised to let that play out. Let's have, you know, these additional primaries. Let's have this debate. Let's have what Sanders is suggesting is a real debate about platform, a real debate about ideas. Let's go deeper, not more to the surface. And in that process, hopefully, right, if Hillary Clinton is to be the nominee, that she is forced to actually, you know, kind of wrestle with some of this, even in a public setting, and that's fine. You know, again, Trump has not suffered by the Never Trump movement, by the people that have tried to stop him. That has actually, in an odd kind of way, strengthened him. You know, he was going down for a while there, and then he started just broadcasting everywhere that the system is rigged. He kind of went back to core precepts, right? And it worked. He's now up in the polls getting bigger numbers. So instead of running from conflict and running from controversy, I think Democrats would be well advised to be less managed, less controlled, and a little more open to the fact that, you know, this is a volatile year. And volatility is not to be feared as long as you're trying to get to some authentic place of, you know, genuinely providing an alternative to what I see in Donald Trump as, a model of authoritarian, rule that kind of reduces to one man, even pushes aside his own party. And then I think it's terribly, it's A, antithetical to American traditions at our best, but B, I think it's really unhealthy. And I think that's fair to talk about.
Well, in terms, though, of the fact that status quo politicians are running in the wrong year, and the narrative may be changed and may have been changed forever, it doesn't mean that you have to lower yourself to the level of personal attacks that Donald Trump has. But to your term of being explainer-in-chief, and I think you're right that the Democratic Convention would be a great venue for this debate to take place. It would seem, though, that much of what Sanders has brought to the table is at the heart of why people don't like politicians anymore, and why they listen to them, and they've heard that before, it's just a bunch of empty promises, because they know that almost all of them are bought and sold and paid for by the oligarchy that runs this country along with, I mean, we've seen from what's happened to our legislators. They've been turned into telemarketers. Mm-hmm. They spend all their time raising money. They don't like it, but that's the way the system is. People know the system is corrupt, and they know they're not going to really listen to somebody who doesn't really break with the system. And I think on campaign finance, I know she said all the right things about overturning it. And frankly, that is the practical way. But this is heart and head. You know, this is what Lakoff talks about in terms of the deficiency, how the right is so much better at semantics and at framing things. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that in terms of the heart and head, somehow there has to be a huge break with political orthodoxy, not in a crude way that Trump will exploit. And he will lower it down to the lowest possible level, but in a uplifting way.
Well, and what's the number one word of this moment is rigged, right? Both political parties have accepted the term rigged as central to this whole thing. And so in the shortest and easiest way of saying this, look, for a very, very long time, Democrats feared proposing big ideas because somebody would call them socialists. Bernie Sanders started out by saying, well, I'm a socialist. And thus, there's a whole space open to declare big ideas. Instead of being afraid of terms, right, I think that this new era tells us, this new moment that we're in, that, you know, part of authenticity, right, is to not be afraid. Don't be afraid if somebody calls you a socialist. Don't be afraid if somebody calls you a radical. Don't be afraid if somebody calls you somebody who's really into big change. Because frankly, it's clear people want big change. And I think Sanders has brought that into the process. The Democratic Party is not going to declare itself a socialist party. That's not going to happen. But it ought to get a lot more comfortable with saying, yeah, some of these ideas are social democratic ideas. And you know what? When you're talking about rapid globalization, rapid deindustrialization, automation of the remaining industries, a digital revolution that's transforming everything about how we work, if you can't offer the underpinning of a social welfare state, as a counter to some of that, with guaranteed health care, guaranteed transportation, real access to housing, real access to education. If you can't offer that as an alternative, then the person who is saying, you know, let's just go to the Wild West, let's just go, you know, blow out all the limits and we'll just do whatever, but still makes all sorts of, you know, unkeepable promises, and that's what Trump is, right? That person's going to do pretty well. I mean, far from running from, you know, a social democratic vision, I think Democrats would be very, very well advised to, A, scope out what the crisis is, talk seriously about what's happening, that our work life is going to transform radically, that our economy is transforming radically, that you're not going to be able to go back to, in simplistic ways, to the things that Trump says is possible, and then say, but what can we do for the future? What we can do for the future is what countries like Germany, what Scandinavia, what other places have done, which is provide a basic guarantee in our lives that we're not going to just fall through the cracks and be left with nothing, and then help people to build for a future that is more humane, more decent, more functional. Now, that's big stuff. That is asking people to think big, and you're going to be attacked for it. You're going to be ripped at it. But you know what the funny thing about it is? Again, if we go back to FDR as explainer-in-chief, all the time, he kept talking about bigger and bigger stuff. He finished off his presidency, not coasting out, but talking about an economic bill of rights, about four freedoms, about rewriting the Constitution of the United States and beating fascism and keeping fascism from ever coming to this country. I would just suggest to you, there's a lot more future in talking big than there is in talking small. And you want to counter, you know, a big talker like Donald Trump? How about some big ideas?
Well, at the end of the day, you really have to counter the beginning of the end of social democracy in this country, which happened under Reagan, when he said that government is the problem, not the solution. You have got to invert that in a way that...
Yeah, maybe start with that line. Maybe that's a really good line. Yeah. Ian, you may have hit on the the winning strategy to say, just stand up there and say, government is not the problem. Government is at least a big part of the solution.
But it's your government.
Yes, you control.
You own it. You control it, not the special interests, not the billionaires.
I like that.
Well, we've
sorted it out.
We've sorted it out.
In a half hour. Very impressive.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to see you, John. And again, I've been joined in the studio by John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and the co-author with Robert McChesney of a number of books, including Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And the latest book together just out is People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizen-Less Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, about similarities between the anti-war movement of the 1960s and the movement that Bernie Sanders has generated. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And I'm speaking today from the studios of WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin. And joining me in the studio is Paul Soglin, the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, who was originally elected to Madison City Council in 1968 while a graduate student. He also was very active in that city's anti-war protests, and his activities are chronicled in David Moranis' best-selling book, They Marched Into Sunlight. Paul Soglin has served 3 tenures and 8 terms as the city's mayor. And welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Soglin.
Thank you. It's great to have you here.
And it's great to see you in person, Paul. And we last spoke when you were an early supporter of Bernie Sanders, when he had that big rally here in Madison very early in the campaign. So what's your sense now of after last night's primary results?
Well,
one out of five. Now Bernie Sanders is saying, well, or at least his campaign is saying, not saying that he's going to go for the nomination, but rather saying that they want all of their people to be able to vote and they want to have a presence and an influence at the Democratic Convention. So how do you read that?
I concur. Let me go back to 1968 for a moment. We had the Gene McCarthy effort to secure the Democratic nomination, which failed under miserable circumstances of the war in Vietnam and the legacy of Lyndon Johnson, which resulted in Richard Nixon's presidency. 1972, we had George McGovern as a candidate in a still fractured party. This, to me, is the first time in my adult years where we've got a chance to significantly not just change the direction of the Democratic Party and deal with the kinds of issues that Senator Sanders has brought up, but to be effective in doing it. And that means this is a very extraordinary opportunity. To do that, we do have to complete the primary season. We do have to have such a significant state as California express itself. And then there's a whole body of work that needs to be done, regardless of who the Democratic nominee is, getting that person elected, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Senator Sanders, and moving on through the Congress, and then post-election, staying with it, particularly on the economic and social justice issues.
But when you bring up the 68 convention in Chicago, and any analogies with Eugene McCarthy, that surely sends chills through the Democratic Party establishment. That's the last thing they want. Now, that's not going to happen. I mean, it may happen on the other side in Cleveland, frankly, but less likely now that Trump has done so well.
No, and I think that that's very significant, that we came out of the chaos in 68 is unquestioned, that we come out of Philadelphia with the 2016 convention more unified. And this is what I'm saying, a chance to be effective. And we already see it in Hillary Clinton. We see it in her movement on trade. We see it on her movement in regards to minimum wage. But there's still a long way to go, particularly in efforts to deal with the influences in corporate America and to fundamentally change the power arrangements in this country, where still, no matter how many tens of millions of people should support justice, it's thwarted in too many of the halls of Congress.
And what did you make of the Republican results with Donald Trump now with a clear path, it would seem, to get the nomination? And we've got an announcement coming today from Ted Cruz. I believe it is that he's going to have Carly Fiorina as his running mate, two of the least likable people on the planet joining forces. Pretty surreal, isn't it?
I mean, I guess Sarah Palin wasn't available.
Now, Donald already peeled her off, you know. So
that's just what you're raising, though, really is what I think is one of the biggest tasks and chores before us, which is, how could a Ted Cruz be taken seriously? How can a Donald Trump be taken seriously, particularly in light of the populist fervor that's spreading across the country, which I think we have to direct into something a bit different, which is a progressive movement? We know that historically, over the last 120, 130 years in this country, that populism and progressivism had their roots in many of the same parties and activities. But there is a difference. And I think it's the result of the continual pounding, the continual relentless pounding of right-wing television, right-wing talk radio, which raises these issues, but then provides a very distorted view of what the solutions are. I mean, deal with Trump himself, which is he gets up there with this message about concern for the working people of this country. Well, damn, for the last 30, 40 years, he's been an expert at exploiting workers around the world.
Well, but the countervailing campaign to Trump, of course, is Bernie Sanders. You know, he would be the left-wing equivalent of right-wing populism. And so if Bernie doesn't make it, which is certainly, the writing seems to be on the wall in terms of being the nominee after last night's results, that would mean that something's got to happen with that energy, with those people, with that platform. If I'm right in suggesting that the only way to neutralize Trump is with authentic populism, left-wing populism, as opposed to this, you know, I'll make you all a millionaire kind of.
And Hillary Clinton is trapped, and she's going to have some real tough decisions to make. I mean, she already understood what was happening in this country, and we saw her, as we discussed earlier, in her movement to embrace a higher minimum wage, a $15 minimum wage, in her recognition of what the Pacific trade proposal means, especially after what we've seen from NAFTA in the last 20-some years. Whether or not, and this is the essence of Senator Sanders' message, whether or not she can stand up to Wall Street and she can fight the necessary battle on distribution of power, distribution of resources, that's another matter. And that's where, in effect, the Sanders supporters have to remain vigilant past the election. It's going to show up in who she nominates to the Supreme Court. But, you know, going back to Barack Obama, we see it in his presidency. We see that element of his insiders who have been committed to undermining public education, who drank the Kool-Aid in regards to charter schools and vouchers and attacks on teacher unions. We've seen it in regards to the discussion on Uber and Lyft and the so-called sharing economy, which in terms of taxi services destroys permanent full-time jobs and undermines reliable service other than when there's entertainment going on. We've seen it in regards to the role of Airbnb. And for example, what it's doing in San Francisco is just an indication of what's going to happen in terms of affordable housing, gobbled up by housing speculators who are going to turn these into bed and breakfasts. And where does that leave the working poor?
Well, I think this is a vital discussion that should be had, and I hope that Bernie Sanders is able to have it. And it hasn't really, we've got some contours of it in the debates. But my fear is that what's happened to American capitalism and with the strength of Wall Street has been, and the growing financialization of our economy, now up over 60%, is that we are in a situation where the power has shifted to Wall Street, and they're all about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. And when you think about what's happening to the kids that Bernie's brought out, the students, you know, we should be making our kids not profit centers, but investment centers. And this is what this form of predatory capitalism that we have in the United States today is doing. If they could monetize the air we breathe, they would, you know, and this gig economy is such a, it's such a snow job. It's like the people in Walmart call themselves associates, not workers.
Right.
It's a title somehow make up for the fact that you're not being paid a living wage, for God's sake.
Or that you need food stamps because your employer either won't pay you enough on an hourly basis or won't give you enough hours. I mean, this monetization of our society. I got into a discussion the other day with some folks about entrepreneurship and capitalism. And the bottom line is this. When it comes time to creating jobs, we all know It's small businesses. It's not the big corporations that make the significant difference in terms of increasing jobs in this country. When it comes time to being entrepreneurs, you don't have to be a capitalist. I'm sorry. You can be creative and form a workers' cooperative. And we've got so many successful examples of that here in Madison and around the nation. Well, are we going to see financial institutions providing the same access to capital for workers to create their own businesses and industries? That's a difference that a president can make in terms of banking policy. But it's not going to make those corporate folks on Wall Street any happier. You know, we've gone through the closing of Oscar Mayer close to 100 years here as the home in Madison. And they just announced that the final dates have been selected for production in March of next year. We're looking at about 900 people losing their jobs. Good union jobs. People who worked really hard, who got up early in the morning in the worst of weather and showed up every day. And the thanks they get is there's going to be a $1.5 billion savings for this international Heinz Crap Corporation with its Brazilian connections, which none of us have quite figured out yet. But the bottom line is that when we educate kids, it's not for the purpose of their being cogs in some big machine like that. And if you really listen to what the employers are saying, they don't want technocrats. They want workers who can think. Well, we're destroying that. And that's the sad part, another sad part of the monetization of our economy and our educational system. Kids are not going to school just to be employees for some corporation. They're going to learn so they can think.
Right, but that is unfortunately not the direction that our education is heading in nationally, where you mentioned the charter schools and all of these ideas of preparing people for work as opposed to preparing them to become informed, educated citizens. I mean, it does seem that the Wall Street and corporate establishment would prefer passive consumers over active citizens. But we pay for that in more ways than one, and that seems to be what's happening to us as a culture. And I think Donald Trump is the kind of reductio absurdum of, and after all, remember what he said? I love poorly educated voters.
Exactly. And while we're sitting here, and since our producer and technical director, as well as myself, was raised in Chicago, you know, yesterday it was announced that the Charter High School in Chicago, which is designed to prepare kids for college, that 100% of those kids are going to college, including going to Yale and so on. Those kids at that prep school in Chicago are 1/10,000th of that population of kids in Chicago, and we don't hear about all the other thousands and thousands of kids in Chicago who are enrolled in a public school system that's failing, led by a mayor who's a solid Democrat, but is basically destroying a city where, and think about this, they can't solve the pension problem, they can't find enough money to keep the schools going, they can find $1 billion for George Lucas's museum.
We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back in a moment, continuing the conversation with Paul Soglin.
What's my name?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com, and we're broadcasting from the studios of WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin, and we're continuing the conversation with the mayor of Madison, Paul Soglin, who is the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin. He was originally elected to Madison City Council in 1968 while a graduate student. He also was very active in that city's anti-war protests, and his activities are chronicled in David Moranis' best-selling book, They Marched Into Sunlight. Paul Soglin served for 3 tenures, 8 terms as the city's mayor. And again, we're speaking from the studios of WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin. Well, let's, in the last minutes that we have with you, Mayor Soglin, go back to your experiences in the anti-war protests of the 1960s, which I mentioned were chronicled in David Moranis' best-selling book, They Marched Into Sunlight. And one of the things that comes back here in the current debate, if you will, or current situation vis-a-vis the two Democratic candidates for President of the United States, with Hillary Clinton now with a substantial delegate lead over Bernie Sanders. And a lot of the questions are about what will Bernie do and what will happen to the movement that he has created. You know, one of the things that happened after the end of the Vietnam War was this massive movement of which you were a part. As soon as Nixon ended the war, it sort of dissipated. You eventually found a way back through politics, but 99% of your colleagues did something else, dropped out, whatever. So this is the puzzlement I have, is that you create this massive movement that Bernie Sanders has, over 8 million voters already and counting. They're young. They're the very people that you need to bring into the Democratic Party, if the Democratic Party is to survive. I mean, after all, the Tea Party, a minority, became the tail that wagged the dog of the Republican Party. Why can't a group of young progressives storm in and take over the Democratic Party?
Well, going back to the 60s, there's actually, I think, a technical, terminological challenge that we've got here. We were the anti-war movement, but we were not really a movement. We were a protest. And it's unfortunate that we considered ourselves to be a movement at the time, because a movement has a program, has a specific agenda to advance, to share, to discuss. And so, as the war wound down, that protest wound down as well. And what we found was that only in certain segments of the country was there actually a movement. We had some of it here in Madison, as many of us entered elected office and continued on in municipal and state government, and even to the point where both our present Senator Tammy Baldwin and hopefully our Senator again, Russ Feingold, came out of that. In California, there was the California Economic Democracy Movement, and we saw it in parts of New York City, parts of Chicago. So now, and this is going to be the challenge in terms of the millions of people who've joined in with Senator Sanders, can we take the principles of that agenda, everything ranging from the inequities in education to the challenges of reforming our financial system, the exportation of jobs, can we take those into a movement which will sustain itself beyond the 2016 presidential election? Can we make it something, as the Tea Party did unfortunately in their own way, and start holding members of Congress accountable for this agenda?
Well, already, clearly, Bernie has moved Hillary to the left on a number of issues, and particularly, as you mentioned, on Wall Street. And it seems inconceivable to me that she could ever bring back Summers or Rubin or any of the people that brought us the end of Glass-Steagall and the beginning of the 2008 crash. I mean, it seems, so what's your sense of what Bernie can do to hold Hillary's feet to the fire and just in this cycle, let alone what he can do afterwards with all of this youthful energy that he's galvanized?
Well, hopefully this youthful energy is going to stay active and take on these challenges. But there's other forces out there. Every time I deal with municipal issues and challenges that I see, I've got problems with the American Beverage Association. I've got problems. We run into challenges with Uber and Lyft and Airbnb. You know, regulation can be good. Regulation is here to protect people in terms of worker safety, in terms of the health of consumers, in terms of consumer protections. And so it's more than just pushing our members of Congress or pushing the president. What we've got to do is be able to counter these forces that these individual companies have and the strength of their associations, which is just monstrous in Washington. And, that's what I see as a mayor when I go to these meetings and I encounter my colleagues. These are just tremendous pressures that are present. And that's part of this battle. Senator Sanders addresses it in his campaign. He hasn't really gone into a lot of the specifics about it, but he knows what he's talking about. He knows what he's seen, and he knows what the damage is. That's got to be, in a sophisticated way, transferred to all of the people of this country so that they can take on that discussion and that battle as well.
Well, Mayor Sugarland, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Finally in person.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Paul Sugarland, who's the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin. He was originally elected to Madison City Council in 1968 while a graduate student. He also was very active in that city's anti-war protests, and his activities are chronicled in David Moranis' best-selling book, They Marched Into Sunlight. Paul Sugarland has served 3 tenures, and that is 8 terms, as the city's mayor. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Norm Stockwell. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again from Madison, Wisconsin tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.